From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, reporting on global warming from the floating ice at the North Pole. We talk with Andrew Refkin, environmental reporter for the New York Times. His new book, The North Pole Was Here, is about a scientific expedition measuring climate change in the Arctic. Refkin has made three trips to the Arctic and has written extensively about the science and politics of global warming. Also, we talk with William Powers about his work in Bolivia, running a large rainforest-based project designed to help slow global warming. He's written a new memoir about the science, politics, and culture surrounding that project. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Andrew Refkin spent several days living on the floating sea ice at the North Pole in order to report on a scientific expedition studying Arctic warming. His new book, The North Pole Was Here, is about that expedition and why the Arctic is so important to the larger story of global warming. Refkin has made 3 trips to the Arctic. He's also reported on environmental issues in the Amazon. Since 1995, he's been an environmental reporter for the New York Times, writing extensively about the science and politics of global warming. In a few minutes, we'll hear an audio recording of the noise made by the Arctic ice he was standing on as it cracked and shifted around him. Andy Refkin, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the expedition that you write about in the new book? What was the purpose of the expedition that you were reporting on?
Well, there's a big gap in our understanding of past climate and actually of current climate trends. It's the North Pole, the middle of the Arctic Ocean. Just to draw a picture for everyone, we're more familiar actually with the South Pole. It's farther away from most of us, but down there, scientists have been able to set up bases. They have doctors and mechanics, and you can come there and go there and stay for the winter and set up instruments that take measurements all the time. The North Pole is in the middle of an ocean. The Arctic Ocean is 5 times bigger than the Mediterranean, for example. It's 2.5 miles deep, 14,000 feet deep in the middle, and it's covered with this sheet of ice that's always moving and shifting and cracking and melting. And so if you want to get a regular set of measurements at the North Pole on what the temperature of the ocean is doing or what the temperature of the air is doing or how thick the ice is, you really can't do it. At least you couldn't until these scientists in 2000 came up with an idea for a way to do that. And it involves a lot of risk, a lot of experimentation, and things break. And I wrote about it first in 2001. And I felt like a kid kind of saying, hey, can I come along? Can I come along? I kept kind of asking them and asking the National Science Foundation, and everything kind of didn't quite work. And then finally in 2003, all the logistics gods smiled, and there was a space on the airplane for me and one other reporter, a woman from the Dallas Morning News, and off we went.
Well, we'll get to a little later what the kind of measuring techniques are for measuring the global ice, but why is it important, why is the Arctic an important place to measure global warming?
Everyone, the science community has come to realize the Arctic has sort of built-in amplifiers, so it can turn a slow, gentle global warming into a pretty profound and dramatic regional warming. And there's various reasons for that. The simplest one to understand is the transition from frozen water to liquid water. If you're in the tropics and the temperature goes from 85 degrees to, say, 90 degrees, it just gets a little warmer and you feel a little weirder. But and I've spent a lot of time down there, too. But in the Arctic, if the temperature goes from, say, 28 degrees to 32 or 33 degrees, you've just passed this really important threshold. Water that was ice melts. And that can greatly reduce the amount of that floating sea ice on the ocean. And once you do that, then you have dark ocean instead of white ice. And the white ice at the pole is kind of like one of the globe's great air conditioners. It takes sunlight and bounces it back out into space like a mirror. When you take away some of that ice and you replace it with dark water, the water absorbs most of that sunlight and warms up more than it would have otherwise. So you get this amplifying effect.
The temperature in the Arctic has risen as much as 8 degrees since the 70s, whereas the average in the rest of the globe was 1 degree in the whole 20th century. So is it this cascading effect that you've just described that's responsible for the steep 8-degree rise since the 70s?
Well, it seems to be the case. And the other thing that happens, too, is if you have less snow cover on land, you also have a darker surface than you would otherwise, and that also can warm things up. The reason these scientists need to go to places like the North Pole to figure this out is the other thing we know about the Arctic is that it has a huge amount of natural variability. The climate system up there has all kinds of wiggles in it. And we feel that sometimes down here in the form of an Arctic, even when the weatherman says there's an Arctic blast coming. There's a lot of the cold temperatures, the atmosphere there has big, giant, wobbly fluctuations on many timescales. Some of them are many years long. So you can't point to a recent wiggle and say, that's finally us. That's global warming. That's the human impact. But so we need to try, the scientists are trying to figure out more clearly what's behind these trends. And one way to do that is to look at the oceans, which are kind of a bank for heat. The more we know about temperature trends in the ocean underneath that ice, the more we'll know about what's driving the big, great climate machine up there.
Now, scientists report that some of the sea ice in the Arctic is melting. Could you actually literally see that while you were there?
You can't really. In any one season, it's kind of like with hurricanes. You can't look at any one season and say that retreat of the ice or that hurricane was a function of this global warming trend. But while I was up there, I was learning a lot from scientists about the measurements that they've been doing with satellites that show the remarkable retreat of the sea ice in summers in recent years. And it's very hard now for them to explain that retreat by looking at anything other than the growing greenhouse effect from things like carbon dioxide, these gases that trap heat. But when you go there on any particular year, you can't kind of say that open water at the North Pole is our fault or anything like that. It's not that simple. We did see open water. You see gaps in that ice. It's kind of like a huge America-sized Scrabble board, and the Scrabble tiles are these ice floes that each one is hundreds and hundreds of yards across, and they kind of grind into each other. So there's always some open water, even in the middle. But what's noteworthy is the pullback of sea ice around the edges of the Arctic Ocean in recent decades, and that seems pretty rare. It seems like at least in the last 100 years, that hasn't been seen. So that's where they start to get the sense that something new is happening.
So one of the things you were doing at the North Pole was reporting on the scientists who are trying to measure whether the sea ice is melting. And at the same time, you're living on the sea ice while you're there. What's it like to be on... What are some of the amazing aspects of this sea ice that you were living on for 3 days?
Yeah, well, everything is kind of amazing. The whole idea of getting into a 15-ton airplane in the northernmost place in Canada, flying north for 2.5 hours. Basically, you fly north until there is no more north, and that's when you know you're at the North Pole. And then looking down, and there's this little camp that these Russian guys have set up, and they brought a bulldozer on a helicopter from Siberia, and they kind of carve a runway into one big flat plate of ice. And remember, everything below you is floating on an ocean 10 Empire State Buildings deep. And then the pilot's circling and telling us he's going to land. And we're landing a 15-ton airplane on ice that's about 6 feet thick and on top of an ocean. And that to me was kind of a grab-the-seats kind of moment. And, you know, should I be doing this? The scientists around me had already been going for a few years, so they were more, you know, blasé. A couple of them were eating apples and peanut butter sandwiches while we were getting ready to land. And then you step out of the plane, and once you step out of the plane, you feel like you could be on the tundra of Alaska, or Antarctica on a big frozen continent. But after a while, then you start to realize that you're on you're not on a landscape. You're on a seascape. It just happens to be frozen. And one of the things that tells you that is sound. It's just one of the spookiest things there was when we were at the base camp, the Russian-run base camp, and I walked away over toward where the helicopters were parked, and I started hearing this sound. It was like every possible sound you could imagine involving things rubbing together. Everything from the styrofoam cooler lid squeaking to giant kind of chugging sounds and huffing sounds and hooting sounds and kind of everyone sort of wandered over there, the Russian pilot and some of the crew and one of the scientists, Tim Stanton. He's an oceanographer from Monterey, California. He's a New Zealander. He's been up there for a few years, and so he was very kind of, oh yeah, this is one of these ridges that start to rise when the ice that we're on starts to collide with another big flow of ice, and all the sound you're hearing is just the, you know, things happening that it's like a sort of like an earthquake, but it's an ice quake under our feet on top of this ocean.
Well, you actually made a recording of what you're describing. Why don't you introduce it for us? Because we're going to hear it. It's on your website, and we have a recording of it. So.
When I went up there, when I go to some far weird place for the New York Times, I feel if I don't come back with this story in every possible medium, I'm not really doing my job. And so I took these TV cameras and one of these neophyte kind of cyber journalists collecting whatever I can, taking pictures and stuff. And so I kept the cameras running while we were walking over to this big ridge of ice forming. And Tim Stanton, the oceanographer I was with, starts to explain what's going on. And it was rather unnerving what he was saying.
So that's who we're going to hear?
Yeah, and then basically you'd hear his voice saying this is starting to crack, et cetera.
So this is Andrew Refkin's recording of the Arctic ice.
You can feel this, the chunk that we're on actually starting to fail a bit more. Probably hairline cracks up the towards the helos there.
So does that mean we should back up?
Not yet. You can always jump over a crack. The power is just, it's unstoppable. There's no mechanical system you could really design to live through a thing like this. The forces are just stunning. And it's the risk. It's the risk we take.
Well, that's Arctic sea ice. It sounds like a motor engine.
Yeah, that last part reminded me of someone trying to start an old truck or a tractor.
Yeah, or even like a propeller or something.
The thing that's so remarkable in all this, and one thing I try to convey in the book, not just as the findings about Arctic climate change, but the adventure of science. This team is doing science on the edge of the possible. Everything they were doing, every bit of equipment they had to kind of design for this project. And as Stanton was saying, you know, the things break. And he had an instrument that he left in the ice up there a few years earlier. And back in his lab in Monterey, he was watching the signals coming from it, showing that it was starting to tip sideways, and then it went dead. And he knew that it had been crushed by one of those ridges. So it's all sort of a work in progress.
When the scientists said to you, you asked, like, what do the cracks mean? And the scientists said, well, you can always jump over the crack. That's a prospect I'm sure you would not have welcomed. That's a frightening thought.
No. While we were at the camp, over a period of hours, there was a crack, what's called a lead. It's basically an opening in the ice where these two big scrabble tiles are rubbing together. It opened up, and you're looking at it, it's just sort of white ice on each side and black water in the middle, and it's very mesmerizing to stare at that. At one point, I was watching one of these open leads, and I don't know if you remember the movie Jurassic Park, where the water in the puddles is vibrating before you see T-Rex, but the puddles, the openings were all the water is kind of rippling to the tune of that huffing ice, and a seal popped its head up. It was the only life we saw in 3 days and sunny nights on the North Pole ice. Just one seal popped his head up. And then another point, I was just standing there watching this and looking at these things called frost flowers that start to form on the thin ice in these openings. And the Russian camp chief came running up saying, Nyet, come back. It's dangerous. Last year, tourists fall into ocean. And it's at that moment that you remember the water you're staring at is not just some little sort of creek. It's 14,000 feet deep. And that really jolted me back and was kind of a sobering experience, too.
My guest is Andrew Refkin, an environmental reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called The North Pole Was Here. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrew Refkin, and he's an environmental reporter for The New York Times. He reports on global warming, among other things. And his new book, The North Pole Was Here, is based on his reporting on a North Pole environmental observatory. So the observatory is actually on this floating ice. So what are the problems it poses for scientists to be reporting from a station that isn't stable?
Well, they came up with a method for collecting information there in a routine way, in a place where nothing is routine. And what they do, they actually don't stay, the instruments that they deploy don't stay on the surface. Some of them do. They put these buoys in the ice and they just sort of float away. There's even a webcam. There's a North Pole webcam that you can go to right now. Just if someone Googled for North Pole and webcam, they'd find it. And it's on our website too, that they left behind. But most of the instruments, the most important stuff, is dropped through a hole that they melt in the ice. On a big long chain, 2 miles long, this Kevlar line studded with instruments that all up and down through the Arctic Ocean from the seabed to the ice itself is recording things like temperature and salinity and which way the currents are pointing. And they leave that there for a year. And it's got little hard drives and those collects this data for a whole year. And then they come back like we did and they get ready to pull that one out and put another one down. And because it's under the ice and it's not actually attached to that floating, drifting surface, it stays in one spot the whole time. But one of the other things that makes this kind of polar science really challenging is they have to have divers. Two of these guys we were with were divers who actually go under the North Pole, essentially. They went down through the same hole, this about the size of a manhole, through a 9-foot-thick flow. They drop into the ocean below. And they're in 28-degree water that's 14,000 feet deep, and they're looking back up at the surface at this little hole. And they go down there to tie a rope onto that big chain of instruments so they could pull it back up again.
How did the scientist divers describe to you what it was like, what it looks like, to be in the Arctic Ocean under the ice?
Well, these are very rugged guys, obviously. There's several of them who rotate every year. One, Jim Ossie, burly guy, bearded. He's dived all over the place. He's an engineer. He's designing. He's also a brilliant sort of inventor. He's working with others to design a probe, a glider, that someday will allow scientists to collect information under the Arctic ice without having to go below the surface. But that's for years in the future. He said, basically, it's the closest thing he'll ever see on this planet to being in space. You're floating in an ocean that's crystal clear. There's no real silt or anything. He said that the visibility is like being in Belize or the Caribbean, hundreds of feet visibility, and you have this kind of glowing, translucent ceiling above you of sea ice. He said you could even see the shadow of the little camp through that ice, even though it was 6 or 8 feet thick. And below you, of course, is just utter darkness. And he said it was a very spooky experience.
One of the things that probably makes it spooky is unless you find that little manhole that you came down through, you're covered by a ceiling of ice.
They had a rope.
Oh, yeah,
just
good.
In case.
Okay.
Yeah, and by the way, and this gets to the reason I called, one of the reasons I called the book The North Pole Was Here, is that the scientists who were working at this camp, sort of as a goof, when they first got there, they set up a little sign with a barber pole, kind of like everyone who goes to the North Pole does. The tourists do this too. Everyone seems to bring their own barber pole to the North Pole. And they put a sign up that said, North Pole is here. But they were aware that after a couple of days, their camp was miles from where they were when they started, because the ice that we're on, not only is it cracking and shifting and making noises, it's moving about 400 yards an hour. So if you're at the North Pole right now, you have to take a step every 15 seconds to stay there. And that's why they, after a day or two, they crossed out the word is on their sign and put in the word was.
What are some of the things that the scientists are measuring in the North Pole, and what are they learning from those measurements?
Well, one thing is that they're trying to understand basically the relationship between the energy coming from the sun and the how much of it gets into the ocean, and how that relates to what happens with the ice. The ocean up there is sort of, it's in layers. It's like a layer cake, where you have a fresh, very cold layer up near the top. And you have actually much warmer water, deeper, which flows in from the Atlantic Ocean, but is sort of salty and denser, and it stays down low. And what's happened recently is that upper layer, the fresh cold layer, which actually helps to insulate the sea ice floating on the top, has gotten a lot thinner. And one thing they're trying to figure out is that layer going to go away? And if it did, then you'd have that much warmer, salty water getting really close to the ice, and it would help melt it even more. And basically, they're trying to understand things that are called feedbacks, where again, some warming of the system leads to much more warming. And that's one that they haven't published the data yet, because this is a project that has to go on for a number of years before you can get a sense of a trend. And again, one of the most important parts of the puzzle of global warming is to understand when something that's happening now is to distinguish whether it's a wiggle or a trend. And they need more than a couple of years of data to get that understanding.
You know, in reporting on the Arctic and on scientific experiments there, you talk a little bit about some of the unusual effects of global warming on the Arctic. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, as that region, warms and it's in a warming trend, people are starting to see the region as a potential bonanza. For what kind of things?
Oh, well, good old-fashioned fossil fuels is one of the things for sure. We did a big series of stories last year in the Times called The Big Melt on how already companies and countries are jockeying for their portion of the Arctic Ocean seabed or the coasts where it's clear there's oil and gas reserves that haven't been tapped yet. And the other thing that's happening is a significant and real concrete push to develop sea lanes through these legendary passages that were impassable for most of human history, not just the Northwest Passage, but actually more likely first the Northeast Passage, meaning going over Russia from Europe to China and back. You could have commerce where it was never conceivable before. And there's talk of sea routes from northern Canada across past Greenland and up into the Arctic Ocean to Murmansk in Russia. And it's not surprising that sort of the commercial realm, companies, entrepreneurs, they're usually the first people to test the changes, to look at a change and see, well, what's the upside here? And they're out there. And there was another science project where they took a core, a cylinder of sediment out of the ocean floor in the Arctic in 2004, scientists, international project. And this had never been done before because you can't keep a ship in one place long enough in all that moving ice that makes things, life up there, so difficult to drill into the seabed. But they finally were able to do it. They pulled out this core, and they found that not only was the Arctic Ocean 74 degrees at the surface 50 million years ago, but it was full of organic stuff, algae and ferns and things. And there's enough of that organic stuff down in that seafloor, even right toward the North Pole, that some of the scientists feel there's a good chance there's oil deposits yet to be discovered, even as far out as the center of the Arctic Ocean. And by the way, one thing to keep in mind about the Arctic is long after it's mostly a blue ocean, there's still going to be a ton of shifting, drifting, floating sea ice up there to make life difficult. And that has some people concerned about the idea of these shipping routes where you might have oil tankers moving through water that's still pretty pretty tough going, and that could lead to accidents.
Andrew Refkin is the author of The North Pole Was Here and is an environmental reporter for the New York Times. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Art of War by Sun Tzu, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields, online at tiaacref.org/greatergood. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, William Powers talks about a project he ran in the Bolivian rainforest to help slow global warming and the controversy surrounding the project. And we talk more about global warming and the Arctic with New York Times reporter Andrew Refkin. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Refkin, an environmental reporter for the New York Times. His new book, The North Pole Was Here, is about Arctic warming and his experiences covering a scientific expedition at the North Pole measuring climate change there. You know, we talked a little bit about the sea ice, which the base that you were reporting on was located on. Is this observatory also looking at glaciers and whether glaciers in the Arctic are melting at an unnatural pace?
This particular project is one pinpoint on the map. It's in the ocean. I've been to the Arctic three times since I went to the North Pole, and the other two trips were to study changes on land in the Arctic. And they're really important because, well, Greenland, where I stood on this the heap of ice that is Greenland in 2004, and it was quite an astonishing experience to be on top of a pile of ice that formed over hundreds of thousands of years. It's an ice sheet that's twice the size of California and about 13,000 feet high in the middle. I spent a couple of days with atlases and emailing a couple of oceanographers. I wanted to convey to readers how much water we're talking about is locked in the ice in Greenland. And it turns out it's basically the equivalent of the Gulf of Mexico. And the melting zone there, that in summer is the area where you get a lot of melting on the surface, has been expanding a lot recently, in recent years. And the temperatures are starting to change. Greenland was sort of in a cool spot in the Arctic for a while, and now it looks like it's warming up. And it's an important question, what happens with this ice, because it represents about 20 feet of sea level rise. So if Greenland somehow magically plunked back into the ocean, sea levels from Bali to Boston would rise 20 feet. And that's a big deal. It would never happen overnight. It will not happen over even a century or 10 centuries. It would probably take several tens of centuries for all of that ice to melt. But it would set us on a new course, basically, where we'd have to redraw coastlines every century or so. You'd have a fundamentally new coastline to deal with. And if you're in a coastal city, like most people are these days, that means a lot. So up there, though, still, it's hard to figure out trends. But many of the experts who are out there doing these individual projects say the thing to try to reflect on and considering what to do or not do about global warming is the whole picture. Meaning, if you look at what's happened with Arctic sea ice, if you look at what's happened with melting in Greenland and with melting in the glaciers on mountains in the tropics and in places like Alaska, if you look at the growing heat in the ocean, which has been measured pretty clearly now, and you look at what's happening with these gases in the atmosphere that trap heat and make the world warmer than it otherwise would be. It's that grand sort of overall picture that is the thing that makes many experts say we need to move promptly right now to start to develop ways to get energy without releasing more of these gases.
I'd love to hear what you think of Al Gore's new film, An Inconvenient Truth, which makes a case that we are undergoing global warming and speculates about what those changes are. What do you think of the film?
Well, it's a very effective film as a film is. Even the sharpest critics of Al Gore, people from the industry lobbies, say it works as a film. My sense personally is that it builds a very lawyerly case, meaning that we're in a planetary emergency right now. That's kind of his conclusion. And he points to specific things happening, like changes in disease patterns, drowning polar bears, Hurricane Katrina, in ways that strongly imply that these things are essentially our fault and that's why we need to act now. My personal sense of the science, having covered this for coming on 20 years, is that it's hazardous to try to sort of connect those dots in a way that minimizes the uncertainties that really are there, that it's the overall picture, the thing that gets lost when someone tries to say this is a here and now catastrophe, everything that's happening in the world around us is a function of greenhouse gas increases, that doesn't hold up as an argument in the end. And it distracts from the things that we know so profoundly. One of the things I tried to do in the book, and that was done really well in a book a few years ago, kind of not an exciting book, but an important book, the Discovery of Global Warming, that I reviewed for the paper, is to build a picture of our understanding of the basic idea. In other words, we know enough just in knowing that these gases are trap heat. There are more of them. They're coming from our activities, and we're heading toward a profoundly transformed world later this century. And seems to be enough. And I think the best thing that we could do is to just convey in the simplest terms, in the most profound way, without the distraction of the legitimate debate about current events, that we're changing the world and that has circumstances that need to be paid attention to.
So you're critical of Gore's film for pointing to specific events that have happened in very recently and saying this is a result of global warming. You think that there's a larger pattern that seems to prove that there's global warming, but we can't look at the individual events and say this one is definitely a result of global warming. What do you think of the science that he presents in the film as, you know, as explanations of what global warming is and what its consequences might be?
Well, the way he conveys the basics of what it is, how it works, is really fabulous. You know, it's kind of a basic primer on how greenhouse gases work. He even includes a whimsical cartoon, sort of a Simpsons-style cartoon that's like a 1950s science class documentary that really gets across the basics in the clearest possible way. And that stuff is pretty unassailable, I think.
And the consequences that he talks about?
Well, the I guess it gets down to what you think will work as a strategy to engage the public. And Gore's film and a lot of media coverage lately has tended to sort of try to cast global warming as the kind of environmental catastrophe we all grew up with in the last century, meaning something that's very simple and clear-cut and a challenge right now, and that's why you have to respond to it. And things like the Exxon Valdez wreck or Chernobyl, you know, we had it so easy in the 20th century in terms of recognizing these things because they were right in your face. They had clear effects right now. The dirty black stuff coming out of a smokestack was affecting your health right now. And I guess there's an attempt underway to try to cast global warming in that same light, because perhaps to take advantage of the fact that people tend to focus on the things that are risks to themselves and not their children or grandchildren. Unfortunately, I don't think it's that easy. I think with climate change, if we neglect to sort of cast it as what it is, which is it's an issue really that ultimately will be a much more profound one for our children and grandchildren than for us. And that, to me, I think has enough power in it too, potentially, to get people to move, to change the way we use fuels now.
The Al Gore movie refers to a story that you actually broke in the New York Times. And it has to do with Phil Cooney, who was had been with the American Petroleum Institute, which is a lobby group for the oil industry. And President Bush had appointed him to serve as chief of staff of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. And in that capacity, he was editing a report on global warming and toned it down and was accused of censorship. You broke that story, and a couple of days later, he resigned from the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and then shortly after that went back to the American Petroleum Institute. How did you get the story?
Well, actually, shortly after that, he went to ExxonMobil.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. I, along with covering the science, I tend to focus part of my time, and I've almost been forced to, as sort of the truth police for years now, trying to understand when someone on one side of the issue or the other is spinning things in a way that doesn't hold up. And for years, I was finding evidence provided by people within the bureaucracy of government, within science, climate agencies, and that kind of thing, were sending me examples of editing or rewriting by the White House that was trying to sprinkle more uncertainty into reports than the scientists felt was justified. And this was a case where someone who I had met in 2002, early on, I kept in touch with him, and he kept saying, well, you know, I've got some stuff here that when I leave government, you'll find pretty interesting. And just sort of by cultivating a source over a period of time and being patient and doing what is fairly rare in journalism these days, a lot of us rotate too quickly from one beat to the other, but I've sort of been on this for a while. That helped me to get those documents finally when he left government and put them in the Times.
So had he kind of like drawn an arrow to the downplaying of global warming that Phil Cooney was responsible for in this report, or did you just kind of stumble onto that among a lot of—
Well, there were no arrows required. What was clear in the documents once I got them was they were actually the handwritten editing marks of Mr. Cooney. And it was all there. In fact, we published in the paper, sort of visually, you could see the way paragraphs and sentences were changed to add a word like may instead of a word like probably and that kind of thing. So it was all in his own handwriting. There was no highlighting required.
You've been reporting on climate change for about 20 years. Is it any more satisfying to report on it now that there's more awareness of the issue? Is the awareness of the issue changing your life as a reporter?
It's, I guess at the Times now, there's been a lot more engagement on it. And the thing that's encouraging is that departments of the paper, and not just our paper, but Business Week, for example, last year did a big series on global warming. And to think of that 10 years ago is probably unthinkable. So in a sense, it's broadened out as being not just an environment story anymore. I guess that's the biggest realm of progress there's been. It's really a story about energy, about the nature of how we integrate science into how we behave, and about looking a little farther into the future than we usually do in the media. So I'm very encouraged to that extent.
And about politics.
And it's clearly about politics, and it's about energy politics, which is the sort of knockdownist politics that exists.
Since your new book is about science at the North Pole, leave us with an image about what it's like to actually be at the top of the world.
It's standing at the place where the sun goes in circles above you, where you're on a transitory surface of ice that's moving and shifting, and that's been essentially unchanged for tens of thousands of years. It's been a place that humans can never feel comfortable. You know, when I saw a seal pop its head up through the ice, the first thing I thought about was, oh, wherever there are seals, there are polar bears, and polar bears like to eat people as well as seals. It's a place where you can never feel comfortable, where humans will never, at least for a long while to come, be able to sit easy. And yet it was a place, as I was standing there, feeling that 20 degrees below zero air on my cheeks, thinking that we're potentially transforming it in a way that my children, or certainly my boys, their children, will later this century might see it as a completely different place than the kind of thing we've grown up with. That's sort of a profound feeling. And the one other thing it was it's the one place I've been on Earth where there's no distractions, no sense of anything other than that you're standing on top of a planet. And it's a planet spinning in space around a sun that you can see in the sky 24 hours a day. And that's kind of a remarkable feeling, too, to have none of the, you know, here back in the real world, where sort of you're driving in your car or you're sitting in a radio studio, you don't think that you're on a planet that's hung in space, a great gift from whoever. And there it's hard to get away from that feeling because there's nothing around you except sort of planetary forces playing around.
And you were there during the period of 24-hour sunlight.
Three long days and nights of brilliant sunshine.
Well, Andrew Refkin, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's really been a pleasure. Thanks, Terry.
Andrew Refkin is an environmental reporter for the New York Times. His new book is called The North Pole Was Here. Coming up, the controversy surrounding a project in the Amazon designed to help slow global warming. This is Fresh Air. My guest William Powers describes Bolivia as a mecca of environmental innovation. There he ran the Amazon Project, the world's largest rainforest-based program to slow global warming. It required getting the cooperation of multinationals and the indigenous people living in the rainforest. Powers has written a new memoir about this work and the controversies surrounding it called Whispering in the Giant's Ear. He now works with the Friends of Nature Conservancy in Bolivia. The country elected its first indigenous president, Evo Morales, last December. In May, he nationalized the nation's oil industry and is trying to increase state control over other energy resources. The Amazon Project was about working, you know, developing an arrangement between multinationals and environmental interests. Would you explain what the deal was?
Well, the deal was that the Bolivian government would set aside a vast tract of Amazon, 3 million acres, forever, and that the multinationals would agree to help pay to have that happen. And they would do that through the international climate change agreements that have taken place over the past 10 years, where they are able to reduce their emissions to slow global warming through one of two ways. One is by reducing emissions or putting in clean technologies Those are brown sources. And the other is through green sources or saving rainforests. So this is one of those saving rainforest types of agreements where the net benefit is something like, billions of tons of carbon reduced from the atmosphere. And they are able to go ahead and get credits for that.
And can you explain how preserving rainforests can counteract carbon emissions?
Well, you can think of rainforests as a sponge. It sponges carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and releases oxygen. So it's actually very simple. It's a very simple idea. And it's capturing those, what we call in the business, ecological services of what the planet does to maintain our water supply, to maintain our climates, to provide any number of services, including aesthetic values, to monetize it, to give it a monetary value. Basically, we're changing the way that global capitalism works. It's changing the fibers of the global economy in ways that are positive, because you've suddenly made something that was free, like polluting or cutting down a rainforest, not free. Now it has a cost, and that cost causes a different behavior in the part of corporations.
So the cost for polluting is that you have to preserve, in this case, rainforest, because the vegetation in the rainforest will inhale the bad guy carbon dioxide.
That's right. That's
and
exactly
exhale
right.
The good guy oxygen.
Exactly.
And does this strike you as like, you describe this project in your book as anti-utopian. What do you mean by that?
It's anti-utopian in the sense that it's not relying on the goodwill of companies or governments to do the right thing. It's changing the economy, the global economy. It's changing economics.
So you think of this as a really pragmatic approach in the short term to dealing with the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And you had people who you knew in Bolivia who were basically accusing you of being in bed with the multinationals. They didn't see it as pragmatic. They just saw it as bad. So what was your response to people who you knew who thought that now you were a bad guy too?
Yeah. Well, that's sort of a knee-jerk reaction, that if you're doing something that involves these corporations, it must automatically be bad. And I agree that it's not the only solution. And I don't want people to have a warm and fuzzy feeling about it that, wow, if we just save all the rainforests, we can go on driving two SUVs and burning fossil fuels for the rest of history. And that's not true. I think that you need both sides of the equation. You need to be doing these types of rainforest projects like we did, and you need to be working with multinationals for the financing, unless someone else has a better idea for how to fund it. And the other side of it has to be really focusing on consumption.
When you got to Bolivia, you were told that in the environmental world, the world divided between grapes and watermelons. So who are grapes and who are watermelons?
Okay, well, the watermelons are red on the inside, sort of very left-leaning, progressive, change capitalism, need to destroy capitalism, but green on the outside. That's one paradigm. The other were the grapes. Those are people who are green through and through. They come at it from a more of a preservationist, conservationist perspective.
And what was
those
the conflict the between grapes and watermelons?
Well, the watermelons really felt like you should not be engaging the global economy at all, at least not the corporate version of global economy. And the grapes felt, well, whatever it takes to preserve Mother Nature, even if that means working with this sort of financing.
So your project was a grape project by these standards, yes?
Okay, by that very simple metaphor, yes, I would say it is.
My guest is William Powers. His new book is called Whispering in the Giant's Ear, a frontline chronicle from Bolivia's war on globalization. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Powers. His new book, Whispering in the Giant's Ear, is about his work in Bolivia running the Amazon Project, the world's largest rainforest project to slow global warming. It required getting the cooperation of multinationals and indigenous people. When the anti-global protests started heating up, you became involved in a really interesting protest, and it was a protest about the government claim on a part of the land coming into conflict with the indigenous claim to that same land. Would you describe both parties' claim to that land?
Well, the indigenous people said that that had been their land for generations and generations. That's their ancestral land, that particular rainforest with its waterfalls and barroches and wildlife and everything. It's part of their mythology, part of their way of living, and their history. And the government was saying, no, that land belongs to logging companies through concessions granted 10 years before, and that's the legal claim to the land. So it's really a question of law. And the dispute came down to a clause in the forestry law in Bolivia that does say that original peoples, indigenous peoples who have been on the land for a certain amount of time, have rights to that land that supersedes concessions, particularly if the concessions are not under use. And those concessions were not under use, and the companies were not paying taxes and other issues around it. So the much stronger legal, in addition to the sort of ethical case for the land, went to the Indians.
But the case is still unresolved.
It is.
Now, in protest of the government's claim that this land was part of a logging concession, the indigenous group, in collaboration with your environmental group and in collaboration with the larger park area, came up with a declaration. What did the declaration say?
Well, the declaration said that this was an indivisible territory, what's called the indigenous territory of the Bajo Paraguá, and that couldn't be divided up and that couldn't be annexed off.
So you joined with the indigenous group when it came to protesting the government's claim that this land should be part of a logging concession. But then one of the leaders of this indigenous group said that in protest, if the government insisted on keeping that land for the logging concessions, that the indigenous group was going to go into the big national park, which is the park where you were running your environmental project. They're going to go into this park and claim it as their land in compensation for the land they felt that they were losing. So where did you stand on this? I mean, this is the park that you're using for your project. Mm. How did you feel about them, you know, invading the park?
Well, I have to admit that first I felt rather betrayed that all the work we'd done, not just since I'd been there from 2002 to 2004 with them, but even before that for years, the relationship that had been built up with that particular indigenous group was strong and solid, and I felt like that's a tactic that I could not accept personally, going into the national park and cutting down the rainforest or annexing it from the national park. At the same time, politics were shifting in Bolivia. This was during the time of Sanchez Gonzalo de Lozada, his government, when Evo Morales and the MAS party was sort of rising in Bolivia, and that group, the Chiquitano Indians, were joining with some of these other social movements in the East, and had become part of a much larger dynamic where the fight was for land and for territory as the number one issue of indigenous people nationally in the country. And it was sort of a by any means necessary.
So you held your ground in thinking that invading the park was a bad idea.
I did, but then after that was announced and became an issue and actually caused quite a scandal and led to some meetings on the national level with the Minister of Sustainable Development and others. Just in informal conversations with the indigenous people, they said it was a tactic. It was a media. It was a way of getting attention, a way of going after what people, in a sense, really care about most, which became sort of obvious in the whole crisis that, you know, there's a real concern for the environment that even outweighed the concern for the indigenous people in the area.
So they never really did invade the park.
They never invaded the park. There was talk of slash and burning a few acres with the TV cameras rolling, but even that never happened.
So were you able to repair your relations with the indigenous group you'd been working with?
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say that they were really that damaged. There's tension like in any relationship, but the relationship did get better after that and continues. But I'm sad to say that they still do not have that indigenous territory as their own. It's still under debate, and I'm hoping now with the big change in the country that 740,000-acre Amazon territory will be legally given over to the Chiquitano Indians.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
William Powers is the author of Whispering in the Giant's Ear. He now works for the Friends of Nature Conservancy in Bolivia. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Boldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of A World Undone, The Story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, by G.J. Meyer. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Louis C.K. He's written for Conan O'Brien, Chris Rock, and David Letterman. Now he's starring in a new HBO sitcom called Lucky Louie that debuted last Sunday after Entourage. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.